This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. And we're going to continue now with our live coverage of TEDx Boston. Farah Pandith is a first in the U.S. government. She's been serving as a special representative to Muslim communities for the United States Department of State, a position that didn't exist before she took the job.
It was created in 2009 by then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And after eight tumultuous years of conflict between the United States and other countries within the Muslim world, she took on the job just before a fruit vendor in Tunisia set himself on fire and therefore launched the Arab Spring.
These have been tumultuous times for the world, for Muslim communities included, and for youth in many of these communities in particular.
Earlier today in her TEDx Boston talk, Pandit said that Muslim youth around the world are not growing up in the same way their parents or grandparents did.
These digital natives are standing on a shifting foundation of religion, technology, pop culture, and world events, and they are confused. Yet despite the diversity of Muslims, there is one central experience that unites them all. Their identities are in severe flux. From Suriname to Surabaya, they're asking questions like, what does it mean to be modern and Muslim? What's the difference between culture and religion? Essentially asking, who am I?
Who am I? And joining us now to talk more about her TEDx talk and what she calls the rumbling youth quake is Farah Pandith. Welcome to Radio Boston. Great to have you.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here.
Well, it's really good to have you. You know, I was really struck by something that you said early in your talk this morning. You said that, given that there are 1.6 billion Muslims around the world, a quarter of the world's population, one might be tempted to think of this sort of Muslim community as sort of this global monolith. But you say you want to characterize it very differently for very good reason.
So it's really important that we understand that. I mean, the numbers tell a really important story. One-fourth of the planet is, in fact, Muslim. 1.6 billion people, 32% of which are under the age of 30. And these young people have grown up in a post-9/11 context. Mm. But with different realities around the world in terms of their culture and their heritage, and you cannot look at them as a monolith, as a one-stop shop, understanding everybody in the same way. There's diversity out there. There's a lot of complexity and there's a lot of nuance. And so, look at my title. I'm special representative to Muslim communities because communities matter. I reject the idea of a Muslim world that there is an us and a them. As if there's something different out there. And I think, you know, I was at the Fletcher School in 1993 when Sam Huntington wrote The Clash of Civilizations. We're all, you're nodding, everybody out there has heard of that piece that he wrote suggesting there's a West versus Islam, and I reject that. Mm. Because you see all over the world complexity, you see unique experiences, and it's important for us to respect the diversity and the dignity of all these different voices.
And what's the opportunity? What is the opportunity that understanding of this sort of multitude of Muslim communities with all their diversity and complexity is out there? What's the opportunity for us when we understand that? And really
sure. So,
that?
I mean, you can look at the way Al-Qaeda, for example, a terrorist organization that uses the name of Islam for its nefarious means, suggesting, in fact, that there is an us and them, that there is a right way to be Muslim, and there's only one way to do it. If you break it apart and you understand and give dignity to the fact that somebody who is growing up in Morocco during the 21st century is having a very different experience than a Muslim in Sao Paulo, somebody who's growing up as a Muslim in Kathmandu, somebody who is growing up as a Muslim in Stockholm. A Muslim voice in Suriname is as Muslim as it is in Surabaya. It is the kind of dignity we would expect here in Massachusetts. We don't look at everybody the same. The first thing we ask somebody when they're from Massachusetts is, which part? Where'd you grow up? Because they're having a different experience. And the opportunity cost is for us to be able to develop local solutions to things that are happening on the ground. And it is those local voices, those communities, that will make a difference. They are credible voices that can build up a counter-narrative to the narrative of a uniform monolith that exists around the world.
Mm. And speaking of that counter-narrative, you said something else this morning that I want to ask you a little bit about. You asked the rhetorical question, where do young Muslims go for answers about their world, about the world beyond their shores or beyond their town or community or country? And the answer is Sheikh Google.
Well, it was
so
sort of.
So this is an opportunity, but also a set of risks.
Right. I mean, it was a play on this. But I think that that the online presence of many ready answers, whether you know you're on YouTube, whether you're on Google, whether you're looking at Twitter feeds or Instagram photos, you're seeing young people go to outside sources for sort of a touchstone on what they're feeling and what they're doing. They're not staying within their families all the time to get answers to questions. And that can be very dangerous because the loudest voices out there right now are those of the extremists. And what I was trying to say in my talk is that in moving in a positive direction, this youthquake, the ideas that are shaking up the world, the young people that are growing up understanding that they want to push away this extremist ideology from their backyard. And the way that they can do that is to lift up their voices in a credible way and provide counter narratives to the narrative of extremists. So when I think about all of the experiences that I've had over the course of the last 4 years in this job, I have been to 80 countries around the world. There is much diversity. There is much complexity in terms of the different experiences that are happening. And if we are going to be able to saturate the marketplace with alternative narratives, it means we have to lift up the experience of a young person who's growing up in New Zealand who happens to be Muslim, or somebody who's growing up as a third-generation Turkish German, and understand that there are differences that are happening. You look at Europe, only Europe, for example. A fourth-generation British Pakistani is having a very different experience than the second generation Moroccan in the Netherlands. I mean, you have to understand that everything isn't the same, that we have to, especially as government, take the time to listen to what these young people are saying and to give dignity to their voices.
You said, too, in your experience and traveling to all these countries and all these diverse Muslim communities, that you've really found an extraordinary array of progressive voices and sort of progressive pushback against the more restrictive ideas that we might have about certain Muslim communities. How can your office sort of help amplify those voices and support them?
Well, so I think the bigger question is how can all of us, because we are one part of a much bigger organism out there, and I think absolutely that it has to be government, it has to be civil society, it has to be the private sector who's taking hold of this. What's happening in the ecosystem on our planet affects everybody. It just doesn't affect those people in the public sector. Mm. So the solutions come from everyone. So what I would love to do is to spark interest by innovators and creative advocates for building more resilient communities to find ways about how we can lift and build platforms that these young people, their words, that their sentiment, that their desire to push back against this kind of ideology is actually amplified. Mm. They can't do it alone. Mm. I'm sitting here in my home state of Massachusetts, and I know what kind of people are listening to WBUR right now. They're inventors, and they're advocates, and they're educational activists, and they're people who find solutions to things every day. Tell me why it is that we can't find a way to lift up the voice of youth around the world who want to build more resilient communities.
Mm. Well, one of the challenges, I want to ask you about one of the challenges that you might be trying to deal with in this position, which is also political, and that is Muslim youth around the world may look at the United States as backing governments and regimes that are not very sympathetic to their futures and to their desire to be as free as they might want to be free. How do we deal with that?
So, Anthony, I think you're asking a really important question, and this is something that comes up a lot. The work that I do is all civil society-based. So I do people-to-people engagement, and I focus on young people under the age of 30. And if you were to unpack that a little bit in terms of the question that you're asking, it isn't, America does not have a foreign policy that is based on religion. Our relationship with India is not a relationship between a Judeo-Christian majority nation and a Hindu majority nation. We're a country that makes decisions on foreign policy based on geostrategic needs, as does every other country in the world. And what we are having to do is to talk about that unfortunate narrative that is out there that exists. And again, it's being pushed by one particular frame of mind. Look, America did this in a country that happened to have communities that are Muslim. We're not doing things because a community is Muslim. Mm-hmm. There are some times that America does do things in countries that happen to have a particular constituency. Having said that, it doesn't mean you can wipe away the reality of the you know, the narratives that are out there that suggest these kinds of things, and a lot of really redundant things that go round and round on online and offline that sort of make compelling points to say, see, look, America doesn't. But the reality of the situation is America is a country that has Muslims in it, and they are proud Americans, and there is no contradiction between being an American and being a Muslim. Mm-hmm. And to do more to talk about the reality on the ground, what our Constitution provides, that many people that I talk to overseas who ask questions about our nation can't tell the difference between the West. So, for example, they hear about something that's happening in Europe and they think that exact same thing happens in the United States, a ban, for example, on building a mosque, the ban on the way you can express yourself through clothing or through wearing a cross or through wearing a bindi or wearing a yarmulke. I mean, it doesn't matter the way you're going to express yourself, or a headscarf. They don't understand the United States, the Constitution provides the right for us to express ourselves freely. So when I am in situations where people do ask questions about the reality of our country, not only our foreign policy, but the way we live as Americans, our story tells a very particular thing about the reality on the ground here, and that Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and Christians and Jews live side by side in America. We don't have ghettos in which we are putting different people, which they oftentimes they do believe.
I'm curious, too, what you hear when you go around the world in terms of the way extreme voices in this country are perceived by these communities that you visit.
I'm really happy you asked that question, and you know that I mentioned that in my mm-hmm. speech as well. This us and them narrative is not exclusive to extremists who are part of Al-Qaeda and its affiliates. Yeah. You see this us and them narrative that is growing not in just in our country, but actually in countries all over the world. In Europe, you're seeing a lot of that as well. But what we are seeing on the ground is that voices that are extreme and shrill in our country are ricocheting around the world, and people believe that that is the mainstream America. They cannot distill the voices that are real voices and voices who are just trying to get their 15 minutes.
So a case in point, for example, a preacher in Gainesboro, Florida, who has a congregation, of 50 people and is advocating burning the Quran, right? We don't know his name, but how is he perceived?
I appreciate you referring to my speech. That's great, and I'm not going to mention his name. What is extraordinary to me is that in every country that I've been to, ever since that event in 2010, every country that I go to, young people ask me, does he represent America? Mm. I remember sitting in a school outside of Jakarta, a very, very simple school, sitting on the ground in a classroom with young kids who are not affluent. And they were asking me, and they asked about him by name and said, does he represent America? Mm. And so an average American doesn't even remember who he was. It's something that happened. It was 15 minutes in the sun, and you know, we've long forgotten. He had 50 people in his church. Why would we take him seriously? But they cannot distill what is in fact reality and what isn't. So what we say, it is so important that we have the freedom of speech. But with all of the 21st century connecting each other and all ideas, when you ask the question, do shrill voices in America count overseas? They absolutely do.
Well, we literally have just 20 seconds left, but I want to ask you, are you optimistic about your ability, about the ability of the West in general, the U.S. in general, to build bridges to Muslim communities around the world? I know it's your job in a way to say you are, but tell me why you really feel that way.
Listen, let me just say, I said that there was a youth quake that's happening around the world, and I absolutely believe it. I believe in this generation. They are filled with ideas and creative innovation to be able to get their stories out, and they're using different platforms. Generation Change is one such example, and I use that in my talk. But from Somalia to India to Australia to Canada to Brazil to Argentina, young Muslims around the world are finding exciting ways to push back against stereotypes and sound bites, and we need to make those platforms real for them.
Farah Pandith is Special Representative to Muslim Communities for the U.S. State Department. Farah Pandith, thanks so much for coming in. We appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Farah Pandith, of course, spoke earlier today at TEDx Boston.
And coming up in this special hour live from TEDx Boston, what's the global market for the most precious resource in the world? Well, that resource is water, and its consumption, use, and conservation could be worth almost $600 billion. And our next guest thinks that the local water technologies companies around here could turn Massachusetts into a wet Silicon Valley. Stick with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.